Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to be bringing you an episode that explores the topic of ovarian cancer, including the impact of late diagnosis and delayed treatment on patient outcomes, risk reduction strategies, homologous recombination deficiency or HRD testing, and so much more. This episode has been sponsored by an educational grant from AstraZeneca. I'm passing over the hosting duties for this episode to Dr. Bridget Scott, a freelance medical writer from MyYas Editorial Services, who's speaking with two renowned experts in the field. You'll hear from Professor Frederick Mahmay from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the National Center for Tumor Diseases at the University of Heidelberg in Germany, as well as Professor Christina Fotopoulou from the Department of Gynecologic Oncology at Imperial College London's Faculty of Medicine here in the United Kingdom. It's a fascinating conversation, so please sit back, relax, and take it all in.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast, Professor Frederick Mahmay and Professor Christina Fotopoulou. Let's start with a question about patient diagnosis. There is no screening program for ovarian cancer. Most patients with ovarian cancer are diagnosed with advanced disease. How does this impact on patient outcomes? Frederick, would you like to start us off?
Well, obviously, stage is related to prognosis. And even if within a stage, there is a lot of differences in disease spread and also disease burden, advanced disease, namely FIGO stage 3 and 4, means that the disease has actually spread within the entire abdomen, maybe even to distant organs, as in FIGO stage 4. And this is obviously related to the potential of having a successful surgery. And the major prognostic factor really is surgical outcomes. So the main goal that everybody should be aiming at is to leave no residual tumor, no macroscopic residual tumor behind. And obviously, the ability to do so is not only dependent on surgical skills, but it's also dependent on stage. And within the stage itself, also about the detailed localization of tumors spreading within the abdomen. So this is the problem that we really face in this disease. Is it usually originates from the fallopian tubes rather than the ovaries in most cases. And there is no barrier between the end of the fallopian tube and the abdominal cavity, and there is a fluid flow within the abdominal cavity. This really leads to a quite rapid spread within the entire abdomen. And this is one of the reasons why it is diagnosed so late. On top of that, it doesn't really cause specific symptoms. So most of the symptoms the patients have are very uncharacteristic and could be mistaken for many other problems, minor problems, and so maybe lead the patients to see the doctor quite late, and also to view to have the doctors view the problem as something completely different and also not as bad as ovarian cancer. So basically, prognosis is dependent on the stage, but what is most important is surgical outcome, which obviously in early stage disease is a lot easier to achieve than in advanced disease.
Christina, would you like to answer that question?
Yes, so I can only reinforce what Frederick has just said. We have just had the final analysis of the UK TOC study published by Usha Menon and Ian Jacobs and team in Lancet just a couple of months ago, just actually in May. And this study showed and has finally answered the question about screening and the value of screening in a normal population, in a non-high-risk population for advanced ovarian cancer. And what this study has shown is that even though we see a reduction, a shift of the stages, the patients are being diagnosed towards perhaps more earlier stages with a reduction of stage 3 and 4 disease. These are in the multimodal screening group, so in the group where patients had some had ultrasound, had tumor markers. This unfortunately was not sufficient to translate into a benefit into a survival benefit. So this is now the one more screening study that has failed to show any benefit in advanced ovarian cancer. There is no discussion that a similar study like it is so far with just ultrasound versus no ultrasound will probably never be repeated again. But there are many, many screening approaches in a completely different way, like, for example, circulating DNA cells, lavage from the uterine cavity. There are many innovative approaches that we even do in Imperial about what type of medication patients by the year or the months leading to their diagnosis, like, for example, for acidity, for abdominal bloating, so that we put it all together and see whether the patterns of habits and symptoms that the patients have before are being diagnosed can perhaps lead us to an earlier detection of the disease. So even though the actual screening studies in a traditional mode have failed, there are many other approaches that are now being addressed that perhaps will help us diagnose this disease in a different way than we do now. Otherwise, exactly what Frederick said, it's important that we try to see these patients, not just about the earlier stage, but also the lower tumor load. A stage 3 disease can be because of a 3-centimeter mass in the omentum and can also be because of extensive carcinosis in the entire abdomen. So our aim is to just get in a lower tumor volume these patients, just because they are easier to operate. They can cope with our extensive surgery much better than if they come to us in a completely malnutrition, hypoalbuminemic, and extensive ascites status. And we have seen that now in the pandemic, that patients who appeared later, not in a later stage, because they almost everybody comes in stage 3 or 4, but in a more extensive tumor dissemination patterns, we just had more problems treating them, just because they were in a poorer condition.
Thank you both. In a similar vein, the next question, research indicates not all symptomatic women seek medical help, and some of those who do wait at least 3 months before visiting a doctor. How does this impact on patient health, diagnosis, and treatment efficacy? Christina?
Yes, so that is a very good point, and that comes back to exactly what I've said before. It's not really just about the actual stage, but about the tumor burden. Since we know that the majority of ovarian cancer patients will be diagnosed in a perimenopausal or postmenopausal status, most of women who will have a bit of abdominal bloating, who will have a bit of digestion, who will have problems going to the toilet, they will in the beginning just dismiss those symptoms as being menopausal. And not just the patients, but also the GPs or the general practitioners, when the patients go initially to them, they will think, initially, this is just perimenopausal, and in the majority of the cases, they will probably be right. But then, just because ovarian cancer is a much more rare disease than the symptoms that somebody would have from IBS or perimenopause. So 3 months is actually, there are studies that even indicate that there is an average of 6 months from the beginning of symptoms of the patient till the actual diagnosis, just because in the beginning, the symptoms are so vague and such a chameleon that the patients won't initially immediately go to their doctors. And then once they go to the doctors, the doctors won't immediately think of ovarian cancer just because of the rarity of the disease. Frederick?
Obviously, having a later diagnosis will potentially increase your stage and therefore also make surgery more complicated and maybe also surgical outcomes less favorable. So to have a later diagnosis than you could possibly have does impact the prognosis negatively. That's quite sure. And many, many of the patients actually do have an odyssey after them, because they then visit their GP, complain about some general abdominal symptoms. And it then again still takes quite a while after they search medical help until the diagnosis really is confirmed. And this is something that does impact prognosis in my eyes, even though, you know, the screening studies that we've already been discussing before have suggested, despite a shift to earlier stages, we don't observe real improvement in prognosis. But still, I think to have a diagnosis at a stage where surgery is easier is something which is quite logic to be beneficial for the patients. So I think it is important that the diagnosis is confirmed as early as possible, and patients should seek medical help as early as possible, and also that the medical specialist that they're meeting will think of the diagnosis. I think this is mostly what really prolongs diagnosis, apart from late presentations to the physician, is that there's so many other things that could cause similar symptoms that are ruled out first. So it's awareness on both sides mostly, but it's the physicians or the medical staff that should be aware of the disease and not prolong the diagnosis.
Thank you. So continuing the theme, from what we've discussed so far, there seem to be educational gaps. Are patients and healthcare professionals educated about the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer? And if not, how best could these educational gaps be filled? Frederick?
So I think this is something which is really difficult. So healthcare providers are usually well-trained and they will know about the symptoms of ovarian cancer, but it's a rare disease. And if gynecologic oncology or gynecology is not your specialty, you're really rarely confronted with ovarian cancer. So mostly it's, you know, what you see a lot is what you think of first. So it's awareness and the confrontation with the disease, which is lacking in many cases. And maybe so education in that respect will help. But in medical training, we all learned about ovarian cancer. So we all know about the disease. But as it is rare, we, you know, as non-specialists, I think there's so many other things which are so more frequent, that these are the things that also occur at a similar age as ovarian cancer, that this is what physicians mostly think of first. So I think this is a matter where education could help, in fact.
Christina, would you like to add to that answer?
Yes, so I fully agree with all the points raised by Frederick. The issue is that there are different healthcare systems in the different world. For example, in the UK, as you know, there are no outpatient gynecologists, but patients, when they have all women, they go for their screening, they go for their smear test, they go for their pregnancy, they go for their menopausal symptoms, they go for their heart problems to the GP. So they don't have really access within the NHS to a primary gynecologist. This means that a patient with abdominal bloating, with a digestion, she will initially go to her GP. Her GP will see her on a day that he or she will see also 50 other patients with IBS, with gastroenteritis, with other non-gyne-specific issues. And of course, these general practitioners, they will see probably one ovarian cancer every few years, yeah, just because it's a rare disease. So they will not think immediately about ovarian cancer. In other healthcare systems where there are outpatient gynecologists, where even within the national health system of these countries, you can go and have your smear test, or you can go and have your annual whatever checkup of ultrasound to a gynecologist, of course, this gynecologist will think more about ovarian cancer than a general practitioner. So there are differences in the access of care and differences in the traditions of healthcare systems in every country that definitely influence the way that people are diagnosed. And I think there is no discussion about that. I've worked in Germany, I haven't worked in Greece, but I'm Greek, and I'm now in the UK. I see the way that patients get presented to us and referred to us is completely different within the different countries. Having said that, education is important, not just for GPs, but even for the general gynecologists. Yeah, there are gynecologists who will mainly see benign conditions just because they are more common. As Frederick said, there needs to be an awareness about the symptoms, about the fact that these symptoms are very vague, are a chameleon, and that ovarian cancer is not as distant as one would think. Yeah, and the perimenopausal woman with continuous symptoms that don't go away with change of diet, with tumor marker that is increasing, they need to be considered having ovarian cancer, even though it's rare. So education is of paramount importance, not just for the clinicians, but also for the patients, yeah, also for the women. Everybody hears daily about the symptoms of breast cancer, of cervical cancer, of colon cancer, but not so much about ovarian cancer. So we need to have a more holistic awareness about the disease.
Maybe I could add to that, because I think what Christina said is very important, and it does, in fact, differ between healthcare systems a lot. But even here in Germany, it entirely depends which of the specialists the patient approach. So most of the gastrointestinal symptoms probably will lead patients to see their GP. I think one of the points that we could improve really is to have the women go and see their gynecologists at a regular basis. And there is still a lot of women who don't go to breast cancer screening programs, cervical screening programs. But if we get women to go for all these screening programs, they will see a physician that is potentially more aware of ovarian cancer too. So this is probably where we can increase not just awareness for ovarian cancer, but increase the uptake in screening programs for other diseases and a regular visit at their community gynecologist. I think this is really important.
Thank you, Frederick. That's an interesting idea.
I may add to this. So important, exactly what Frederick said was very, very important. However, for example, there is no community gynecologist in some countries. It's exactly the point. So in the UK, you go and have your smear test screening by the nurse of your GP. You have your mammogram by the person who is doing the mammogram, but you don't really have an access to the physician to examine you necessarily. So that is exactly the point about differences in practices and about access to care and specialist teams.
Thank you both. How does genetic screening provide an opportunity to intervene in ovarian cancer? And what role does prophylactic surgery have in disease risk reduction?
Yes, so we have done extensive progress in that regard in the last decades in ovarian cancer. We have now understood, as Frederick said in the beginning, that ovarian cancer is actually a disease of the fallopian tubes, the high-grade serous subtype at least. And therefore, we have now even studies and approaches that we do a two-stage approach where we have first salpingectomies and then later completion of oophorectomies. There are many studies in that in Canada, in the Netherlands, also in the UK. And we have had great luck in being able to hear them, the results of those the preliminary results of those in our ESCO meeting in Copenhagen last year. So yes, genetic screening is important. It's being much more adopted now than it was in the past. The women have now much more options than just having immediately the both ovaries and tubes out. We're talking about the value of contraceptives, the value of ultrasound, the value of two-stage procedures. So we have gone much further in terms of progress compared to how we were in the past. And there is also a lot more to come.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I think the approaches that we have nowadays with a two-stage approach, having a salpingectomy first and an ovarectomy at a later stage, I think will increase the acceptance of these approaches in young women. So after their completion of the family planning, and there is not just the question of having children or not. I think this is not a question anymore, but it's also the question of the hormonal function of the ovaries as such. And to have an option where you remove the fallopian tubes, but leave the ovaries behind for a while. So that you potentially remove the most dangerous part of that. And after the period where the endocrine function ceases anyway, you remove the rest. I think this is a perfect approach that increases acceptability of having prophylactic surgery. And in fact, this is a measure which is so highly effective in reducing mortality that it is very sad if it is missed. And if it's missed due to the failure of not doing genetic counseling and BRCA testing, this is something that we really need to avoid. And I think potentially due to the introduction of PARP inhibitors and at the very early stages, the necessity for BRCA testing to give these drugs, this has increased. But still, I do see patients for second opinions that come, had surgery for advanced ovarian cancer, high-grade serous. They just get recommendation from their treating hospital for platinum-based chemotherapy and maybe even bevacizumab, but no one speaks about BRCA testing, even PARP inhibitors in that context. So I think acceptance has increased through the measures that Christina has just mentioned, and also testing has increased a lot during the last couple of years, mainly due to therapies available for patients initially with BRCA mutations, but we're going to talk about other indications and other aspects of disease where these will be highly effective too in a minute, I guess.
Yes, the next question is on to HRD testing. What is HRD testing and why is it important? Frederick, do you want to have the first shot at that?
All right, I try to explain what A to D testing is. So A to D stands for homologous recombination deficiency. Homologous recombination is a method of DNA repair to repair double-strand breaks, and it's needed for the accurate repair of double-strand breaks. There is some other mechanisms that can also repair double-strand breaks, but they're inaccurate. So if homologous recombination is not working, so there are defects in homologous recombinations, and the other repair mechanisms like non-homologous end joining step in, then there is an accumulation of genomic chaos, and that leads to the cell death eventually. Two of the major genes involved in homologous recombination are BRCA1 and 2, and this is really how the field evolved, the knowledge of BRCA1 and 2, and its implication in homologous recombination repair led the way. But we know now that about 50% of patients with high-grade serous ovarian cancer have defects in homologous recombination repair in the tumor. And many of those are not based on BRCA mutations. So they could be other mutations in other genes important for homologous recombination repair, because it's a very complex mechanism with other genes involved. But it could also be alterations in gene expressions, maybe caused by promoter hypermethylation, for example, in BRCA1 or RAD51C. And there's still a number of mechanisms that we are not aware of, so we don't know. So in order to identify patients that really benefit substantially from platinum-based chemotherapy, but also, and this is probably more important nowadays, from PARP inhibitors, researchers have thought of a way to identify all these mechanisms in one step. And as opposed to really testing for all these different alterations that could lead to HRD, so deficiency in a homologous recombination repair, they have found a way to look at patterns, distinct patterns that are caused by the defect in homologous recombination in the genome. So genomic fingerprints, or they're also often called genomic scars that are caused by these defects in this mechanism of DNA repair. And this can be done by NGS and state-of-the-art molecular methods.
The only thing that I would add is the easier and more financially easier access to this testing, both germline as also somatic. We all know that in the different countries we have started doing genetic testing in the last years routinely. Still, it's not always as easy as one would think. Sometimes even to access the tumor samples, to send them, who takes over the financial burden of that? So these are all issues that I think we need to still, as health body of clinicians, streamline a bit more, so that the tests that are highly crucial for the determination of the journey of those patients are easier, simpler, more cost-effective, so that everybody has access to them.
Thank you, Christina. So you've already started to describe the landscape of HRD testing. How much interest is there in this testing, and which tests are currently validated for use? And do you have any more comments on the current landscape?
Everybody now, in terms not just the healthcare professionals, but also the patients' charities, the patients' voices, and internationally and nationally, there is a very big interest and trend towards genetic testing. The patients now in clinic, before they ask me about how the debulking will be and what chemotherapy they will need, they ask me whether they can have a genetic testing. So the awareness is much there, and it's nothing compared to how it was in the past. And the patients also know that it's not just about their daughters and children and granddaughters. It's also about the options that they will have themselves in terms of PARP inhibitors, in terms of access to clinical trials, prognosticators of survival, etc. So I think we have done a lot of progress in that. In terms of what tests are available, this is different. They vary in the different countries. And the access that we have, so for example, in the UK, in the hospital, in Imperial, we have to send our samples and also the blood and tumour tests elsewhere to have them tested. So it's what I said before, it's not really everything as straightforward yet as one would expect them to be. Frederick?
I agree. So accessibility to test is of a very high importance. And last but not least, in the end, it's who's paying for the test. And in some circumstances, even here, it is not regulated. So you have to ask the healthcare providers if they would. There is a consortium in Germany for familial breast and ovarian cancer. They have issued guidelines whom to test. And most of the insurances do actually cover the testing. But in some cases, this can be really difficult, especially in private insured patients. And accessibility to the testing should be very low threshold because it is important, not only for the families, but as you mentioned, for the treatment of the patients themselves and the whole treatment strategy, really, even over many lines of therapies if the disease recurs.
How common is HRD testing at diagnosis, and how important is it to determine the best course of treatment for women with advanced ovarian cancer? Does HRD testing have a place in early ovarian cancer? Frederick?
So if you refer to early ovarian cancer like stage 1 and 2 disease, the HRD testing doesn't really play a role because there is no licensed indication in early disease for PARP inhibitors. That's different for BRCA testing because that goes beyond the targeted therapy with PARP inhibitors. But based on that, so if we don't change the way we treat patients based on a test, we should not perform the test. So in early stage, HRD testing doesn't have a role yet, but BRCA testing does because it goes beyond the therapy. It does have implications for the families and so maybe indications for risk-reducing surgeries in family members in that family.
Exactly the points that I would raise. I think the issue is that all the studies for PARP inhibitors that we have, they show a benefit in the patients that were included, they were stage 3 and 4. So as Frederick said, we don't have any evidence of any PARP inhibitors for stage one or two patients. I personally believe, if I had a crystal ball, that if we do a study, these patients will also benefit from PARP inhibitors, but that's a different discussion. And I think this will come at some point in the future. But for now, to do HRD testing without a clinical consequence, as Frederick said, it doesn't have any true value. BRCA testing is different. BRCA testing is important just because of the patient herself. These are patients with an excellent prognosis in stage one, so they will live many years to be able to get breast cancer. So these are the ones who... where BRCA testing is even more important, not even more, but very important, and also for the family. But I refuse to believe that the role of all these novel agents, PARP inhibitors, of the PARP inhibitors family, will be restricted to stage 3 and 4 patients. I think in the future we will see differences also for the earlier patients. I mean, you know, stage two patient, they are rare. And is it stage two because we missed to do the microscopic diaphragmatic biopsy and which is just an occult stage 3 and we just don't know? So stage two patients are very difficult. They're actually early, but they're not. So I can't believe that the PARPs won't have a benefit to them, but we just need to prove it.
Christina, I agree. So I think they will be beneficial in early disease. Maybe even not as an addition to chemotherapy, but maybe there is even an option to have it instead of chemotherapy. And stage two in fact is a very difficult but rare disease where there is a high potential for having missed a stage 3, really. So I think they will work in earlier stages too, but for now they're just not approved.
Exactly that. So I think we will see many evolutions in the future, but for now we don't have any evidence.
Could we just touch on how HRD testing could be used to determine the best course of treatment for women with advanced ovarian cancer?
Okay, so basically the magnitude of benefit which is derived from PARP inhibitors in the first line treatment is dependent on the HRD status. So patients with BRCA mutations or HRD positive tumors derive the greatest benefit from PARP inhibitors. And for this population, there is also a potential combination with bevacizumab. So if you tended to use, or you, if you are inclined to use bevacizumab in such patients, and you now want to add a PARP inhibitor, namely olaparib in that case, on top, this would be restricted to an HRD positive population. So in order to get access to that combination, you need to perform HRD testing unless you have a proven BRCA mutation. At least in one of the trials, a PARP inhibitor, namely niraparib, also provided some benefit in an HRD negative population that has responded well to platinum-based therapy, which is so the clinical surrogate for benefit for PARP inhibitors. But the magnitude of benefit was substantially less, and so maybe many of the physicians would be less inclined to see that as very important. Now, for management and patient's adherence, I think it is very important to know the magnitude of benefit that you will derive from some treatment, because it does not just benefit you, but you will also have side effects. And some of the PARP inhibitors do have side effects that can be quite cumbersome, not just effects on thrombocytes, but it's a maintenance therapy that you should be taking for 2 or even more years, and it can cause fatigue, nausea, and this is something that troubles patients and will maybe put them off unless they know how huge the magnitude of benefit is. So there's two reasons to really test, and they're all related to identifying the magnitude of benefit that you will derive from a PARP inhibitor. First of all, obviously, for those who are HRD positive but BRCA negative, you have an indication where you can use bevacizumab in combination with a PARP inhibitor. But also in those cases where you want to use a PARP inhibitor alone and they're BRCA negative, but they're suffering from side effects and are thinking of stopping therapy, and you discuss with them dose reductions, etc. And so really to have a number or a magnitude of benefit that you can really tell them does help to keep patients on the treatment, because obviously a therapy can only be effective if it is really taken. So this is, I think, the reasons why HRD testing beyond just BRCA testing is important. And, you know, you identify an additional 20 patients on top of the patients that are BRCA mutated with HRD. So it's an important proportion of patients.
Again, fully agree with everything that Frederick has said. I mean, it was very interesting a couple of years ago when in ASCO we had the presentation of the Velia trial, the Prima study, the Paola study, that every patient's, even though there was a generic benefit from the PARP inhibitors, the differences in HRD, in the HRD status, in the BRCA status, showed a clear difference in whether those patients benefited or not from the different PARP inhibitors. It was a very nice example to see three trials presented in one session, and every PARP inhibitor had a bit of differences an effect in survival, depending on whether the patient was HRD positive or not, and whether she was BRCA mutant or not. Fact is that I always like to quote what Jonathan Lederman says, the dark side of the moon, which is the HRD negative and BRCA non-mutant patients, which are a considerable amount of patients. Yeah, so we keep forgetting them sometimes, I have the feeling, because we're also very excited about those who are HRD deficient and BRCA mutant. And we tend to forget the rest, which are actually the majority probably of the patients. So we have seen in the PRIMA and the NOVA study that those patients, even those patients will benefit from the PARP inhibitors, just less compared to those who have a genetic background, but more compared to placebo. So those patients still benefit. And therefore, it is very important that patients with at initial presentation of the disease, and this is how we do it in the UK currently, that the patient who has just had the initial diagnosis of a primary ovarian cancer, unless it's a mucinous type, they all go for HRD and BRCA test, because there will be an impact of how we choose the drugs, not just whether they will have PARPs, but also whether they will have PARPs in combination to Avastin, which trials they will have access to. But it is very important that we don't forget / ignore those who will not have the beneficial or more favorable genetic profile. And these patients still benefit from those novel approaches.
So what is the level of knowledge and understanding of HRD-positive advanced ovarian cancer among healthcare professionals? How significant are any gaps in knowledge and understanding in terms of disease diagnosis and patient outcomes? Christina?
Yeah, so coming back to my answer in the beginning, again, it strongly varies between the different healthcare systems and how generalists are the clinicians that are the ones who will initially see the patients with the first symptoms. I see that in my daily practice here that the GPs, the more general practitioners, they still are focusing the importance of genetic testing in terms of the family. Yeah, it's not fully clear to everybody that these patients actually they need genetic testing and HRD testing, not just because of their family members, but because for themselves, because this is a difference in survival, in prognosticators, in access to new drugs, etc. So this is not very, very clear to everybody yet. I have no doubt that it will be with continuous education and awareness in the future, but currently it's not yet. So I think it's for many people and for many general clinicians, this all genetic HRD testing is more, it has more the value for the family and not for the patient.
I have the same views on that, really. So we still need to educate and increase the knowledge in more general physicians and oncologists. But I think we're doing well, and programs like this are part of that and will increase the knowledge about HRD testing and BRCA testing, not just because of the familial risk, but because of the therapeutic implications.
You've indicated that it's useful to know the HRD status of patients with ovarian cancer. Is that the case in every patient? And with that in mind, what are the clinical options and strategies for HRD negative patients? Frederick, would you like to start us off with that?
First of all, ovarian cancer is quite a heterogeneous disease, not just in terms of HRD and BRCA, but also in terms of histologies. And there is the high-grade histologies, high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid. But then there is low-grade carcinomas as well, low-grade serous, low-grade endometrioid. So if you look into the label of PARP inhibitors, they're restricted to high-grade histology. And so in terms of does everybody need an HRD test, I think those where you can be certain and you have reassured yourself, discussed the case with your pathologist that this really is a low-grade serous carcinoma based on state-of-the-art pathology, that's probably a patient that does not need an HRD test and for whom a PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy would also not be indicated or approved. So currently, from the available treatment options that we have for these kind of diseases, first of all, it's extremely important to have really good surgery with the best possible outcome. And then there will be candidates for state-of-the-art chemotherapy and for advanced disease, also in combination with bevacizumab. There's currently a lot of development going on in that type of disease and also the HRD negative disease in terms of targeted therapies, but they're not clinical practice yet.
Christina, what are your thoughts?
Again, fully agree. The guidelines are that all patients with a high-grade endometrioid and serous ovarian cancer, they need to have HRD testing, BRCA testing. The patients with a low-grade histology, the patients with a mucinous histology, we know that the rates there are much lower, so they don't fall into this category, and therefore the therapeutic options there are not towards PARP inhibitors, but other like MEK inhibitors, like a colon cancer type treatment, etc. So it's just a different disease. Yeah, ovarian cancer, we like to call it ovarian cancer, but it's actually not one ovarian cancer. It's a big group of heterogeneous diseases. Mucinous ovarian cancer is almost a completely different entity than a high-grade serous ovarian cancer. Clear cells, they come mostly for, they're more associated with endometriosis, again, another background. Where other options play a different role. So ovarian cancer is not ovarian cancer. Yes, it is a heterogeneous group of diseases, and this is the way that we should see it. And therefore, trials that are not just treating everybody the same way now anymore, but they go according to the histological subtype, to the tumor profile, this is now the way of the future. And genetic testing, HRD testing, will equally be different in the different categories.
And now to our final question. What is the future for treatment and management of advanced ovarian cancer? What does the future look like for HRD testing in particular? Christina?
Thank you. That is a very nice question. I hope and envisage that in the future we can just have a simple blood test in the clinic when the patient comes, and in the lab when we just remove the tumor, without having to fill out 1,000 forms and ask who will pay and how, and so that we just have an easy access to HRD testing for all our patients without the headache we currently have, which, and this headache is more in some countries than perhaps in others, but it is still a headache. So this needs to somehow go away. Currently, we need to ship samples elsewhere to get access to this testing. All this should cease. The awareness should increase. Podcasts like today, like Frederick said, will contribute towards that. HRD testing will have to be one of the crucial jigsaws for the treatment and management of ovarian cancer in the future. We have done massive progress compared to how we were in the past. I remember still when we started gyno-oncology more than 2 decades ago, we were just asking whether the patient has had any family member with ovarian cancer, and if not, we wouldn't even discuss genetic testing. Yeah, not even discuss it with the patient. So we have gone far away from that, but there is still a lot of room from improvement in terms of accessibility, easiness, cost effectiveness, and this will definitely come.
Yeah, I think local testing options, academic tests, are one of the most important things that we need to achieve in order to avoid sending samples off somewhere else. Currently, we've got only one lab who really is able to perform the validated test in Germany. Ideally, a blood sample, I think that sounds like the best idea, but there is a long way ahead. And then there's other things that we need to improve. I think currently HRD tests will miss a couple of patients that potentially benefit from HRD testing. You cannot really explain the benefit from the HRD negative group in the PRIMA trial. And so this could be achieved by novel techniques that take into account other markers of HRD. And also, we need to decrease the proportion of patients with unknown results, so where the test comes back with no results. So this could be due to the sample that we send for testing. So we need to assure that the samples have the required quality and the sufficient amount of tumor tissue. But it could also be to many other cases. And actually, within the trials that we've seen, there was 18% of patients that had a test results that came back without any HRD classification. So this is something that we also have to work at to improve over the time, and then have tests that are reimbursed locally and that are reliable. There's many efforts going on within the ENGOT currently to establish these validated academic tests, which then could be performed locally.
That was a fascinating discussion of the emerging role and value of HRD testing in ovarian cancer. Thank you very much, Frederick and Christina, for your thought-provoking insights into this interesting subject.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, and have a nice day.
Thank you very much. Many greetings from London. Thank you for all your effort in the education about this very important topic.
And that concludes our podcast on the latest developments and emerging role of HRD testing in ovarian cancer. A big thank you to our host, Dr. Brigitte Scott, and our two experts, Professor Frederick Marmé and Professor Christina Fotopoulou, for sharing their thoughts and insights. If you found this episode insightful, head over to our podcast hub at www.emg-health.com. Again, that's www.emg-health.com, where we have plenty of other episodes like this. And be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.